Committee of the Criminal Law Revision Commission, Subcommittee Number 2, October 9, 1969, 1 p.m., Room 315, Capitol Building. Today's subject, abuse of public office, preliminary draft number 1.
Abuse of public office.
I think it's in the back of the book.
Say, what are we going to do with this revising the sex crimes? We're, I understand that we're not going to discuss them tomorrow.
No. We're going to schedule it for next month.
All right. Kick it off, Raj.
Okay, we don't, we have a relatively small article here. We've only got 6 sections. Section number 1, page 1, definitions, and we don't propose any new definitions. We just incorporate 3 definitions that are found in other articles.
Of our revision.
Yeah. Sub 1, benefit and public servant, they're in the bribery article. Number 2 is high managerial agent, which is in the article on parties to crime. Because you're familiar with the definitions of benefit and public servant, mm-hmm. That article went through here.
All right, what's the high managerial?
High managerial agent. Means an officer of a corporation or any other agent in a position of comparable authority with respect to the formulation of corporate policy or the supervision in a managerial capacity of subordinate employees. They generally mean a director, officer.
Okay.
Page 2. Now, we had Section 2 and Section 3 both involve official misconduct. They're broken down in 2 different degrees. We had previously discussed a section on official misconduct in the statute on bribery, and it had been deleted from the article on bribery. It wasn't in exactly the same form as this here. It was, there was just 1 statute rather than 2.
Is this a usual crime in the states?
Mm-hmm. Yes, in fact, in the summary, we give some examples of the different states. Various state cases, there's a New Jersey case, Florida, Kansas, and Wisconsin. There's a proliferation of Oregon statutes that cover the same type of offense.
We're going to repeal these, right?
Yeah. You see where we have existing law, we probably have about 12 or 14 statutes listed there. And there's actually quite a few more if you went through the regulatory statutes. Well, I'll read Section 2. A public servant commits a crime of official misconduct in the second degree if he knowingly violates any statute or lawfully adopted rule or regulation relating to his office. Now, the only difference between the degrees is in Section 3, and official misconduct in the first degree requires the intent to obtain a benefit for himself, in other words, the actor, or to harm another.
I'm sorry, I lost that, Rod. What's that then?
Section 2, official misconduct in the second degree, doesn't require an intent to benefit the public servant or to harm another.
It does require
a knowing violation.
Do we like the term lawfully adopted rule or regulation? Why do we feel it's necessary to have a lawfully adopted?
Well, in that area, we're talking about primarily administrative rules and regulations.
Elsewhere in the statute, when we refer to violation of a rule or regulation, do we use the same?
Well, I suppose the word lawfully used here is it'd be some question if a violation of a rule that wasn't lawfully adopted could be made a crime.
Well, I know, but could you not say lawfully adopted statute?
You could, but we're trying to distinguish statute from administrative rules and regulations.
I know, but perhaps I'm straining at a nap, but isn't it technically possible for a statute to be illegally adopted?
You mean illegally enacted?
Enacted. Well, what I'm saying is, for some reason, you've added a lawfully adopted mm-hmm. rule or regulation. Now, the presumption would be, without the word lawfully adopted, presumption would be that it would be a lawfully adopted
right.
rule or regulation. So somehow we feel necessary, and I didn't see it discussed, to, although I realize they've used in some of the other states, feel it necessary to add those two modifiers to rule or regulation.
I suppose if you deleted it and had knowingly violate any statute or rule or regulation, if it were not lawfully adopted, then the defendant could raise that as a defense.
I would think so.
It wouldn't do any violence to the statute as such. The term lawfully adopted is really gives more protection to a party who's going to be charged under the statute.
Well, the grammar. Kind of, if he knowingly violates or lawfully adopted, if he knowingly violates any statute or violates any lawfully adopted rule or regulation, the grammar is what called my attention mm-hmm. to it first. Using what then? The OI, the participle?
Yes.
And use the participle once to define the act. Violation and use it the next time to modify the rule or regulation that he violates. Well,
of course, I would have no objection to deleting lawfully adopted. You're correct in the statement that there would be a presumption in favor of the legality of any rule or regulation or statute.
Well, I'd hope that would be the law. How do you feel about it? I think my concern is that it puts too much emphasis on the lawfully adopted that would be a matter of defense.
Well, what if he didn't have it? Would it still be a defense? What if the statute was, in fact, not lawfully adopted? Or the,
it'd be the rule.
Or the rule. Something like the problems they had with the drug problem, remember? The Board of Pharmacy mm-hmm. Board.
That was Judge Vole ruled on that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, he ruled both ways on it.
Yeah, there was a later opinion by a different judge, but he ruled it had not been lawfully adopted.
Yeah, it hadn't conformed to the statute.
It's a dangerous drug list.
Yeah. Would it, if we take out lawfully, do we preclude that defense?
All we're talking about, as Roger pointed out, the administrative practice. We're not talking about whether the rule or regulation itself is lawful, is constitutional. That has nothing to do with it, technically. We're talking about the adoption, whether they've, and I think Roger's point is correct, that what the intent here is that if I'm going to be held criminally for violating a rule or regulation, then that rule or regulation must necessarily have been properly adopted by the agency or the group.
Well, it seems that you have another interesting thing here. You require a knowing violation. You're not necessarily requiring that the defendant have knowledge that it was lawfully adopted. Because in most cases, he wouldn't
yes.
have knowledge one way or another.
That's right. Well, I think it's totally for the protection. And I think the drug thing that Harold brought up is pretty good example.
So in a way, you're giving a defendant an advantage. Even though he knowingly violates a rule, he's going to have an out if it later is determined that it wasn't lawfully adopted, even though his intent was the same.
I think they should have to prove it. No, yeah? They should have to prove it.
You think that would...
That would be an element of proof of the state, wouldn't it?
Yeah, they have to prove that
it was lawfully adopted.
Well, let's leave it, and when we get discussing it with the full committee, if I forget or if I'm absent, if you'd raise the question, I think that I have conflicting theories. I'm reluctant. Some of the rules and regulations that our agencies adopt, I kind of hate to make them crimes without making them jump through some particular hoops before they do it. So I'm reluctant to get rid of it, but I think it kind of compounds an awkward sentence to begin with. Okay, well, let's go to section three then.
Public servant commits crime official misconduct first degree with intent to obtain a benefit for himself or to harm another. One, he knowingly fails to perform a duty imposed upon him by law, or one clearly inherent in the nature of his office. And two, he knowingly performs an act constituting an unauthorized exercise of his official duties. And number one, we're talking about acts of omission or nonfeasance. Number two, we're talking about acts of commission or misfeasance or malfeasance, all of which require this intent to obtain a benefit.
It's kind of an interesting area. You know, regarding the second one, the area of malicious prosecution, the law in Oregon now is that if the district attorney files a complaint and without, you know, any adequate substantiating facts, that he's cloaked with immunity, because he was acting under the color of office.
You mean even if you could show malice and no probable cause and the whole thing?
Yeah. This would leave us kind of in a, you could, while he wouldn't have a civil action, you might very well be able to prosecute him criminally, couldn't you, if he did that?
If you could show an intent to obtain a benefit, well, you could show an intent to harm another, of course, there's your malice. He knowingly performs an act constituting an unauthorized exercise of his official duties.
But I think
suppose it is an unauthorized exercise of official duties for district attorney.
I think your commentary says, though, doesn't it, that it's not intended to, in the negligence area. This is the negligent failure. This requires a willful misconduct. Doesn't it?
Yeah, that's at the bottom of page 3 and top page 4. Both sections require a knowing violation of duty. It is not intended that ordinary neglect of duty or negligent performance of duty should be tested.
Are you satisfied, Roger, that the these two statutes, sections, pretty well replace the multitudinous sections in the existing law?
Well, I think it pretty well, I think it covers them all, except for reasons which are probably obscure by now, because these statutes have been enacted over a period of 100 years. There's a wide disparity in the penalty provision, ranging from 30 days to 20 years, and all for various species of official misconduct. But you'll note a lot of these, like on page 6, these statutes. For example, ORS 162-640, now that's a 20-year maximum felony, prohibits any public officer from making a profit by loaning or otherwise using public funds in his custody. A lot of these type of things are going to be covered by other articles on theft, on embezzlement, and these type of things. Whenever you have your public servant making any profit, getting some direct economic benefit out of it. Now this, I don't, I question on that one though, 640, and there are a number of those. Loaning money in his custody, that statute doesn't require any benefit to the public servant. He could loan his brother-in-law money where in an area where he wasn't authorized to, for some sort of harebrained project, for example. And there would be no direct benefit to him at all. Now for some reason they seem to feel that was worth 20 years. Where I would anticipate that sections 2 and 3, section 2 would definitely be a misdemeanor, and section 3 would certainly be a low grade felony, grade C felony at the most. But these statutes have not been used. There's a real dearth of cases in Oregon. So I theorize their main effect's been as a deterrent.
What about this one that Gortmaker asked us to get rid of and we didn't? Election violations.
Duty on the prosecuting attorney to prosecute upon forfeiture of office.
which puts quite a burden on a district attorney.
What statute is that?
No, it's in an elections deal somewhere, that if the district attorney does not prosecute to the full extent of the law, then he is subject to being thrown out of office and prosecuted himself.
Mm-hmm.
The result is that Gortmaker had to go out and, some say zealously, and others just say unfortunately, prosecute all sorts of election violations. Other district attorneys, where violations occurred, such as in Clackamas County and others, did not prosecute, and in turn were turned over to the Oregon State Bar for ethic violations for failure to prosecute. So the poor district attorneys were taking a pretty severe rap, I think.
You know, it's kind of interesting, too, now, because of the, since the last session when we made the office nonpartisan, cast a different light on it, because they were always worried about having a Republican district attorney and a Republican alleged corrupt practice conduct and difficulties of procuring a prosecution. But I don't know, in a way I think it's a pretty good statute, tempered with common sense.
Well, actually, you read our existing one of our statutes, 162.510, which is an official misconduct statute that applies to everyone in the state except Supreme Court judges, the governor, and the legislators. It would seem to also apply in the case of a district attorney, because it says who willfully refuses to perform any duty pertaining to his office, and then it gives with intent. But one of the intents is the manifest hindrance or obstruction of public justice, whether it was intended or not. It seems like a district attorney that wouldn't prosecute could probably
under that, under the sub two here. I'm going to be interested in seeing Frank Knight's attitude when we talk about the wife comes in and wants to sign a complaint charging her husband with assault, which never get issued.
Well, this is the thing that concerns me, is that are we, I grant you it's in there now, but are we providing the district attorney enough leeway to exercise his common sense?
Well, of course, none of this, neither of these statutes is supposed to cover any official action requiring discretion. They're all supposed to be non-discretionary requirements, but I think it's a fact of life that a district attorney in particular exercises discretion in areas that really aren't discretionary. In other words, he might feel it's not profitable for the state to prosecute in cases where you could probably find a statute that says he should. And you're correct, perhaps he could be charged under the statute. Although you, as I say, under Section 3, you would have to show an intent to obtain a benefit for himself, which I don't think would be present, or to harm another, which ordinarily wouldn't be present either. But Section 2 probably would apply, because they don't have to show any intent, just a knowing violation of any statute that pertains to his office, like the statute you mentioned.
Well, I think what we've got going is Bob Chandler was in here before you came, and we're talking about corrections at one end of trying to get some consistency between we were talking about the juvenile code, for instance, where it depends where the judge has his hang-ups or his interests. He was referring to a juvenile judge in his area a number of years ago that was big against booze. So possession, that sends you to McLaren, boom, like that. Now the guy they got apparently, or have had recently, doesn't bother him, but he's got his problem with sex. So it depends the jurisdiction. And my comment was, well, even more so, it depends on the district attorney as to what's big in the county. It depends where he's got his sharpest spear. And I don't like that. I think that makes corrections a difficult area, because something that's tolerated in Klamath County may just almost be the life sentence here in Marion County. And I think that's wrong for a corrections program. Bob's answer was, and I agree, that we ought to give some latitude to the district attorney. And this is the point. Are we, on the one hand, am I in the position of urging that we take discretion away from the district attorney and try to make a better corrections program? And now I seem to be arguing that we ought to give him some discretion. But I do think we have to leave enough room to exercise common sense.
Under the present law, does he really have discretion to refuse to accept a complaint if, you know, adequate evidence to issue a complaint is presented?
Well, as I understand it, he has to accept it, but I don't think he can be forced to act on it.
I see. But they usually do, of course, is get a hot seat on them, they take it, and they submit it to the grand jury.
Force it out.
You would have to bring an action, what, in mandamus, to try and force him to move on it.
Force him to act.
And I don't recall ever reading a case in Oregon where that's been done, at least with the district attorney. It has been with circuit court judges.
And sheriffs.
Well, you're correct. On section 2 and 3, there's no way to draft an official misconduct criminal statute without creating some possible hazards if it's misused. The only way to do it is to make, as we have in our, that Mr. Langley, for example, was prosecuted under for. It's an official misconduct statute for not prosecuting gambling, is to make the penalty really non-criminal, forfeiture of office. Now, that statute that he was prosecuted under is a $100 fine maximum, forfeiture of office. And perhaps in these situations, what you really should be concerned with is forfeiture of office and not a criminal penalty. As long, because obviously, if they're going to get any direct benefit in the form of money or something, you're going to be able to prosecute them on,
yeah,
yeah, on the
else.
Other.
Yeah. I think the obtain a benefit or to harm another, I think, is makes Section 3 less objectionable to the point I raised. But we still have Section 2, which
perhaps we don't need Section 2. Section 2 actually is broader. While it's a lesser crime, it really opens up more possibilities in Section 3.
What type of misconduct are we? Can you think of an example, Roger? We're talking about
there's it. There's some examples. There's no examples in Oregon. I think I give some examples in not under this commentary, under the commentary on official oppression. It's on page 14. Now, these official oppression cases could be prosecuted just as well under official misconduct. But I noted on, I was studying these today, that I think I could find other grounds to prosecute about every one of these.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, People versus Rudolph, extortion, bribery perhaps. Certainly an accessory to perjury. But he was going to commit perjury. Number two, I suppose, would be a better case in point. Wherein that's a really an official misconduct situation where they probably, just offhand, I can't think of any other criminal statute that he could be prosecuted under. Number three is really an extortion case. And these state codes that are mentioned here, for example, the Kansas statute includes official misconduct and official oppression. And the only criminal case that I could find that's ever gone up in Oregon involving anything in point is the Langley case.
And it was the failure to prosecute.
Now, he was charged under at that statute, I think he could have been charged under 162.510, which is a provides for a year, you know, fine and forfeiture. But he wasn't. So I assume that they were concerned just primarily with his forfeiture of office.
Can't the penalty, what the penalty situation here take care of our problem, Mark? Wally, set the penalties.
Well,
talking initially, we're talking about willful conduct.
Yeah, but we're talking, let's take section two, because if you get into section three where he's going to get a benefit or not,
yeah,
let's just take section two where he knows that the law requires him to prosecute to the full extent of the law, and blah, 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 blah. Take your case. The wife comes in, swears that the husband committed acts of sodomy upon her, demands the complaint be issued. And he says, ma'am, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to get involved in your domestic difficulties.
Come back after the next session.
Pardon?
Come back after the next session.
So, then she goes to the Attorney General's office someplace and charges him with official misconduct in the second degree, for which he is guilty,
That's true.
And that's the law now, isn't it, right?
It would seem to me that would be the law under, 162.510. It's the general statute prohibiting unlawful acts of omission by public officers.
It's the law, but it's not being enforced.
That statute, as far as I can see, has never been used.
Well, I don't like it, but I'm fearful of taking it out would perhaps that the threat of it being there is enough to.
I think they've got to have something in there that they
they've got to perform.
They're gonna, yeah, because otherwise we put the district attorney in the position of more than what the office intends for him.
Maybe what we ought to do then, I think you're right. Let's leave it in there and say that what we'll do is, in those areas that we don't think the DA ought to push, we'll repeal the law. Which is the straightforward way of going at it. Rather than let him take the brunt of being outguessing the legislature and what constitutes an illegal act and a legal act, we'll just say, if it's on the books, enforce it. If it isn't on the books, then you're not charged with the duty of enforcing it.
I don't see any way. I've always been upset with the district attorney's offices that I've had contact with in regard to this beating and within the family. And you can get a real aggravated situation. You call and you never get. And it's always upset me because it seems to me it is the law and they're there and I can understand the practicalities of it, but I don't.
Well, yeah, there are a number of areas they approach that way. Bad checks is another one,
yeah,
that they don't, they aren't interested in.
That's a good example right here. Okay, well, let's, Harl, you want to leave it then?
I think we ought to leave it.
Okay.
We're on three now. Three, four.
Page 12. This is an official oppression statute, and what we're talking about is really just another form of official misconduct. Public servant commits a crime of official oppression if the knowledge that his conduct is illegal. He acts or purports to act in his official capacity to, number one, subject another to arrest, detention, search, seizure, mistreatment, dispossession, assessment, lien, or other infringement of a personal property right, or two, deny or impede another in the exercise or enjoyment of any right, privilege, power, or immunity secured by law.
Raj, how does that differ in subsection 2 of section 3? Especially section 1 here, subject another to arrest, detention, search.
The only real difference is that subsection 3 requires an intent to obtain a benefit for himself or to harm another, where official oppression statutes don't. They only require knowledge that he's acting illegally.
Does away with the malice problem.
Section 4 is really somewhat analogous to a civil rights type statute.
Reminds me of that ad.
Sub 2.
That ad on what? Was it Dodge or the new one about the cop? I think that's got to be.
Watch yourself, boy.
What? Don't pass yes. law, sir, boy.
I know a sports car when I see
it. You know.
We don't presently have an official oppression statute. There is one statute, chapter 421, giving some protection to prison inmates, preventing violence and injury to inmates. And then there's a statute, the civil rights section, which just declares the state's public policy against discrimination. And all the other statutes that would be in point are would be were listed under the sections 2 and 3.
I like it. How about you, Harley?
Yeah, I think it's okay.
Well, you're persuasive today.
Oh, you
want to try for section 5?
Just in a good mood. You're just anxious to get the prostitution.
We get that today?
That's next.
Let's move right along.
We approve the rest of it.
We're proposing a crime. Opposing statute making it a crime to patronize a prostitute.
We're going to do away, propose doing away the prostitution as a crime?
No, we're going to broaden it so we can get the patron too, from all these men in jail.
One of the most interesting speeches I've given.
Gracie had a bill on that last time. Remember we.
No, it's passed.
Her bill, well, her bill increased the penalty for the pimp. Yeah. But I think she had another clause in it.
Yeah, well, she had
about the participant, you know.
Well, one of the speeches I've given was to a Unitarian Church adult forum, and they wholeheartedly endorsed our program. The only thing is that they were a little chagrined that we're stopping short of legalizing prostitution, which a number of the members felt was.
Yeah, I'm a Unitarian.
You can sure make an argument. It's a social problem and not a crime.
Well, you know, I had to admit to being arbitrary because they hit me on practical, being a consenting adult, and two consenting adults.
I propose the statute because the other states have, and then I argue for 5 pages against it. But Mr. Platt's in favor, so he's going to defend it.
Where were you? You should have been there. Or do you
belong
to the
local?
Yeah, last Sunday night.
Oh, Sunday night?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't often go to the evening programs.
The Adult Social Action Forum. A good time. Very good audience.
I should do that.
One of the few that was pleasant.
They have some pretty interesting times, even here in the Salem Church. It's a small group compared to Portland. Well, page 16.
Is this the Haynesworth statue?
I think Haynesworth is going to go back to Carolinas. Probably the next man, though, might be a little more conservative nominated.
I don't think they're going to nominate anybody else. I think if that court dies off, we're going to fight.
Man court.
Right. No many guys.
Take my man, you don't get one. Section 5, page 16, misuse of confidential information. This is posing a new law for Oregon. We don't have any law on this subject. A public servant commits the crime of misuse of confidential information if, in contemplation of official action by himself or by a governmental unit with which he is associated, or in reliance on information to which he has access in his official capacity and which has not been made public, he, number one, acquires a pecuniary interest in any property, transaction, or enterprise which may be affected by such information or official action, or two, speculates or wagers on the basis of such information or action, or three, aids another to do any of the acts specified in subsections 1 and 2 of this section.
Mm-hmm.
In one respect, on some of the criticisms of Judge Haynesworth, is kind of the point.
The thing that bothers me about this type of thing, I think it's a great idea, but when you get to which may be affected by such information, you get into the, well, into the Haynesworth problem. Which may be, not even that was affected, just may be affected. And those poor slobs of us that still have to go out, how about, well, you have to actually acquire an interest, don't you? And you have to take an affirmative action. I was just
acquire the interest, and it have to be.
What is I got a good question. What does speculates mean to that sense?
Betting on the Oregon State Stanford game. If you know that half the team has.
Well, that'd be a wager.
Oh.
Speculates are wagers on a basis. That would be buying stock.
Mm-hmm.
So primarily stock transactions.
So just it's similar to, or it's about the same thing as number one, that acquires a pecuniary interest in the property.
And I would think that speculate and wager are intended to be used
interchangeably
in really talking about, for example, stock transactions. I don't think wager means betting as such, since that would be an illegal transaction in any event.
What wager
would it be then? If you bought stock, he would be acquiring
a
pecuniary interest.
Well, I don't think wagers, I didn't mean to use wager here in the same sense as gamble.
Good addition.
Yeah, this one here.
Oh, you got one already?
Yeah.
I don't get a cookie. You want a cookie, Harley?
Yeah, coffee too. You want a cup of coffee,
right? An uncertain event, a bet.
Right. I got it right here.
To hazard, risk, or venture.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Cookie?
No, thank you.
That's the definition. It conflicts in this statute because the basic definition they've given of wager is that which is risk on an uncertain event. And of course, we're using it here that it isn't an uncertain event, that you are putting your money on what you happen to know is a certain event.
Well, what does Section 2 add that isn't covered by Section 1?
Situations where you do not acquire a pecuniary interest, but that you somehow get economically involved.
Well, wouldn't that be the, for instance, let's see.
But I could see another possible problem with speculates or wagers, and that is what Harl mentioned, just exactly what does it mean? Number one's clear. But you could seem like perhaps speculate very collaterally to an issue.
Well, you could have some. Clay Myers could certainly have some information available to him as chief election officer of the state, which would cause him to speculate that Tom McCall be reelected. I'm sure it wouldn't be contemplated that he would be violating Section 5.
What does speculate mean?
Maybe we didn't look at
that. Well, what I'm saying is, speculate in a stock sense is what when you buy speculative stock.
I think it means a great deal.
Betting,
the same as wager.
But doesn't
risking on an uncertain event.
Yeah, but couldn't you? Doesn't one speculate without? In other words, is it necessarily pecuniary? For instance, Harl's example.
No, I don't believe it is.
Secretary of State Myers speculates that McCall will win the election.
For example. to ponder a subject in its different aspects and relations, to theorize from conjectures without sufficient evidence. Now, number three is the commercial definition, and that's how it was intended to be used here. To enter into a transaction of venture, the profits of which are conjectural are subject to chance.
Which is the same thing that one says.
Mm-hmm.
Which may be affected, certainly says the same thing as...
To buy or sell with the expectation of profiting by fluctuations in price.
Well, this is Harlow's question, doesn't acquires a pecuniary interest that which may be affected include...
It would seem like the definition given there on speculate would always involve the buying or selling of a pecuniary interest so that it would be covered by number.
It would always be affected by it, either up or down, yeah. Which is what speculation, the risk. Are we agreed that the intent of the word which may be affected... which bothers me because that's awfully broad. It's necessarily tied in with the idea that he must buy or acquire this pecuniary interest as a result of some information that he has, confidential information that he's derived. In other words, the fact that he coincidentally buys Brunswick stock.
Yeah, because it covers, it says, if in contemplation of official action by himself or government agent, or in reliance upon information which he has access,
so
he acquires.
You really need the misdealing.
It's misuse of public information.
In coincidence such as, for instance, allowing your broker, wasn't that what...
The Brunswick situation, though, would not be covered here, I don't think, because it was the Brunswick company was in no way affected by that secret information, or the stock was not, I should say.
Well, I know, but it's which may be affected, and I would think that in a given, perhaps not a tort suit, but an antitrust suit, or...
And of course, his argument was it was not acquired in reliance on this information that he did have,
yeah.
What had not been made public.
It was acquired by his broker.
Right.
And that's his argument. Far be it from me, I got enough trouble getting into that one. But what I'm trying to do is, I don't like to hang in parties on coincidence. If the guy takes the information by virtue of being a judge or a legislator, knowing that, or a public administrator, knowing that, for instance, the freeway is going to be built along here and runs up and buys the property, then as far as I'm concerned, you can hammer it to him all you want. But the coincidence that he does something that affects land values on the south coast of Oregon, the fact that he owns property or buys property should not necessarily, unless you have these elements as laid out in the crime.
I would think you'd have a prima facie case if, one, he was a public official, two, he had access to and did acquire public information that was not made public, and three, after acquiring that information, he acquired a pecuniary interest in property that may be affected by that information. I think you'd have created a prima facie case, don't you, Rodney?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's reasonable enough with the exception that one I mentioned, and that is which may be. Perhaps that's a little too broad.
Which?
In other words, does the language which may be affected mean that it doesn't have to? And you don't even show that
which
it was.
Which would be the Brunswick situation.
Yeah, yeah, you don't even have to show then that it was affected. But that at the time of the acquisition, it could have been, perhaps.
Of course, I agree, but let me argue the other way. Coming back, then really the intent might be just as evil on the part of the public official, but if the circumstances
didn't work out,
then he's not committed a crime. It's just tough luck.
The highway
commission
changed
their
mind.
Yeah, right.
You have to profit to lose.
That's right. You have to be profit to be a criminal. Otherwise, it's just tough luck.
Well, this is another one of those situations where I think you're going to get involved in district attorney discretion. I don't think this type of statute is going to be used unless there's some gross impropriety.
I think this idea.
I kind of think we should, because otherwise, you're just saying it's okay to try to commit this crime, to misuse public information, as long as it doesn't work out good for you. We're kind of
Yeah, I think it's all right. I think that, for instance, in the Brunswick case, if Harl's indicated that those are the three elements necessary to the DA to prove a prima facie case, and the defendant would come in and say that, one, in fact, it was not affected by it, and two, there was no reason to believe that it would be affected by it. A decision in a tort case of a major company like Brunswick would not, into reasonable people, cause any effect in the stock.
Actually, Life magazine had an article on Senator Thurmond 2 or 3 weeks ago where they brought out that the highway department in South Carolina was building a highway and a new bridge at Charleston.
Let's pick on the Democrats.
He purchased some property about 2 miles up the river, and for some reason, which wasn't made clear in the article, the highway department decided to build a bridge 2 miles up the river and needed that property for their bridge abutments. That would seem to be more on point here, is if he had some inside information that they might be changing their mind where to build the bridge, or he might have told them to build it up the river.
The latter is probably more likely.
Yeah, he bought the property and said, Charles, I think I build it up there.
Looks better up there.
All right, I have a motion on this section, if you're prepared for it, to strike subsection 2 all the way through the word or, and in subsection 3 make it subsection 2.
Well, I have a suggestion then, since subsection 3 I think can be incorporated into one. And then we can get rid of 1 and 2 altogether and have just one
paragraph.
That's good.
Acquires or aids another to acquire a pecuniary interest in any property transaction.
Yeah.
That's it.
I move the amendment.
Okay, I'll second. I'll dispense with a vote in the... All right, I'll ask you to vote. All those in favor, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Carry. And our thinking for the minutes, if any, is that rather than to eliminate 2, that 2 is covered by 1. Right, Carl?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All righty.
Page 20, section 6. This is the last section. Sorry. This is not in substance the conflict of interest statute. It applies to failing to disclose a conflict of interest.
Back to Haynesworth. Get away from it.
Public servant commits the crime of concealing a conflict of interest if, one, he exercises a substantial discretionary function in connection with a pecuniary transaction involving the government, fails to disclose in advance a known conflicting interest in the transaction to either the public, his superior officer, or the attorney general. And sub 2 defines what we mean by conflicting interest. It exists when the public servant is a director, manager, or high managerial agent, or owns directly or indirectly, which would be, say, through his family, a substantial interest in the private entity involved in the transaction.
This has to be a known conflicting interest. This wouldn't cover a situation where...
it's a fairly...
Contractual.
It's a fairly narrowly drawn statute, really, because, number one, the defendant is going to have to be a director or an officer or a high managerial agent of this private corporation or company that's dealing with the government. He's going to have to know that the conflict of interest exists. And he's going to have to be exercising a substantial discretionary function. In other words, if it's not discretionary, he doesn't have to disclose conflict of interest, since theoretically he wouldn't have any options in the matter anyway.
Are we running any risk? There's some rather vague definitions here that I wonder if they would stand the test of constitutionality. And make in advance a known conflicting interest to the public. What's that mean? I think probably most people say tell a newspaper man, but in my judgment, that ain't telling the public.
I assume it would mean a public announcement. However one makes a public announcement, and I suppose the most common is to through the newspapers or via the radio, or now it's to television.
I suppose you tell a newspaper, but for some reason or another, it ain't newsworthy and is not, in fact, then put out to the public. Telling a newspaper reporter is not, in my judgment, telling the public.
And well, I see what you mean by the problem. What is telling the public?
Yeah, and then you have another problem here, a substantial interest in the private entity, where, in other words, you mentioned in your statement, your summary of it, that just now, that the director or officer or high manager or agent, granted, you know whether you are or not, but where do you come as a substantial interest? Is that...
Whenever you use the word substantial...
Oh, this is what I'm
Yeah,
picking.
You're always faced with kind of like a case-by-case. Is 20% of the stock, now like in corporation law or tax law, you do have some rules. Not necessarily in point here, but on what is a controlling interest. Yeah.
Let me.
What's a family-held corporation? That's sort of how much stock you have.
Let me ask two questions. One, you have a state legislator who has a substantial stock interest in a contracting firm, and a bill comes on the floor of the House to appropriate money for the building of a new state building. Right at that point, would this statute be in that area?
Question I'd say is, does he have a substantial discretionary function? I mean, is he going to be
can
on
he award the contract?
Sealed bids?
I don't think so. How about,
for example,
things like mutual funds? What if you know you belong to something that has mutual funds, which then turns around and invests in other portfolios or some such thing? Is it conceivable nowadays to have interest in a corporate entity and not really be apprised of it? Is that, that's probably not really possible anymore, is it? Or is it?
I think if you had large stock holdings, it would be because of recent mergers and consolidations. And in other words, a lot of companies are operating now where it's difficult to know who actually owns them.
Right.
Okay. Just for the commentary, I want to see though now, if we take the rest his soul, Ev Dirksen's situation, law firm, and being in Congress and Senate, and
still a member of the firm?
Still a member of the firm, and representing builders or contractors or other people, and then voting on legislation that materially affected those clients. I don't know, I'm just kind of worried. This is such a...
There is quite a bit of federal law on, and there is federal criminal law on concealing, failing to disclose conflict of interest. But when you're talking about United States senators, it's rarely applied. And one thing, as far as someone like Senator Dirksen is concerned, I don't think he made much of an effort to conceal the various transactions he was involved in. I mean, it was always common knowledge that he was a member in name only, perhaps, of a Peoria law firm that did quite a bit of government business, and he always said he steered a lot of clients that way, and that he admitted he got a certain percentage of the profits.
Well, the thing that would concern me is, first of all, I don't think this statute is drawn or intended to include such things as having, and we have those in our legislature who are interested in contracting. That's their livelihood. And I don't think when we appropriate, pass a budget on a highway building or a new state building, as you said, Carl, I don't think that this statute contemplates that type of discretionary action to build, to authorize a fund or not authorize, even though he may come back and bid against it or bid for the thing. I don't think that ought...
If you look on page 17, there are a number of existing statutes listed that are in point. And most of them involve various public servants involving themselves in contracts, government contracts.
I think this is what the intent of it is, to get at the... I think, frankly, the intent of it is the kind of thing that we're running into now in these Army investigations, where supply sergeants and
club officers form a corporation outside and then deal with themselves as an alter ego. And nothing illegal in the sense that the embezzling any funds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, this statute wouldn't make that illegal, the doing of it. It would only make it illegal not declaring it.
This, would it also take an insurance commissioner that owns stock in an insurance company doing business in the state of Oregon?
I think that might come up if he... I'm trying to think, first of all, you have a discretionary function. In other words, the insurance commissioner making a decision perhaps on revoking a license where the facts were in dispute.
Or rate increase.
Yeah, where he could approve or disapprove. And it would involve a pecuniary transaction. I suppose anytime you revoke an insurance company's license, that's a pecuniary transaction, although I think the term is used here primarily in a contractual sense.
I think we should come, don't you?
Oh, I think so. As long as we're not... I don't want to get down to the things that you were worrying about.
No,
That's why I worry about after the Splint Infinity, Superior Officer, Attorney General. The public is difficult. And then, of course, does the Superior Officer, does it end right there? And that's all you have to do, is tell the guy up one level. I guess. That kind of bothers me. And then the substantial interest bothers me, and I just wonder if, in fact, if we're not getting awful vague. And this does constitute a crime, and I wonder if we run into the void for vagueness.
I think you might have a problem with the substantial interest in the private entity. I don't think there's any problem with substantial discretionary function.
Oh, no. I'm just worried about the practicality of how to absolve oneself of the crime.
From my own recollection, in most of the corporation law and tax law statutes I read where they get into this problem, they usually do lay out a definite percentage. For example, if they're going to say you have a substantial interest, they say, well, that's 15% of the outstanding common stock.
Well, why shouldn't he disclose it? If we draw this narrowly, and our intent is to make it narrow, why don't we have... Now, the or indirectly is designed to what? To pick up the family interest?
Family holdings.
One, really, you don't own indirectly then. That's a euphemism, I mean a cliche. My wife can own something, and it may be her direct ownership, but it's clearly not my indirect ownership. I don't own it indirectly. Say my wife has U.S. National Bank stock. She owns it, true, mm-hmm. but I don't own it indirectly. So I wonder whether owns indirectly has any legal definition. How do you own something indirectly? Through trust would be the only way I'd
know.
How to do it. And I wonder if we could tighten that up by making just owns or has an interest in a private entity involved in the transaction. Isn't that what we're trying to get?
Or owns a substantial interest?
No, just wipe out substantial interest. Owns or has an interest in.
Oh, I see what you mean. In the private entity.
The official then can really divest himself of his holdings to his wife during the period of time doing
well,
this, and he'd be out from under one.
All right, and let's say that we pick up the immediate family, and then they're defined immediate. Well, the only thing I'm saying is I don't think indirectly. I'm convinced in my own mind that's too vague to withstand the.
Well, here's the problem you've got. Obviously, if a private entity that the public servant is interested in is owned 90% by his wife, that could be a very real conflict of interest. Well, he would have no stock interest in the company himself at all.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, this is rather common to have your wife or your children. That's what Bob was talking about earlier. They have very complicated property arrangements now. Lyndon Johnson was an expertise in this. He, poor man, didn't have any money at all himself.
Well, I have no objection, but if we're going to do it, we're going to have to be pretty tight and not just say indirect ownership, because in my judgment, it won't hold. I have no objection to extending it to effective, which is about as equally as void.
Well, this is the problem you get into when you get involved in conflict of interest statutes. Because then you try and draft something to indicate that you also would be considered a conflict of interest if a family member, like a wife or a son, owned a substantial interest in it. But then what if the son is the director?
Well, what if, the officer. What if the son's 55 years old? You know, I suppose maybe they haven't spoke for 30 years.
Right, because then you open it up to situations where probably
maybe man didn't even,
he wouldn't have any personal interest in the matter.
Well, of course, here again, all we're worrying about really is not divestiture, but mere disclosure. So I'm not sympathetic to the man who has not spoken to his son for 30 years. I still think it would be incumbent upon him for his own benefit to disclose to his superior officer that my son owns
what he knows.
What he knows.
We have to define what the conflicting interest is before we can get to the issue of him failing to disclose it. What has he failed to disclose? Well, we're saying he's failed to disclose a conflicting interest. Well, what's the conflicting interest? If it's not going to be covered by the conflicting interest, he isn't going to be covered by the statute.
Right, all right. Now, do we define immediate family anywhere? That's a bad choice from a decedent's estate standpoint. Suffers as does relative.
How about, this isn't very good, but I think it's maybe an improvement. Who owns directly or controls a substantial interest in property?
What about the wife then? Does it depend on who wears the pants in the family?
Well, I see.
Of course, if you want to stretch it even further, you may have situations where your public servant defendant is the wife.
And the husband, yeah.
And the husband controls the company, this outside.
I think we can be relatively tough, though. I think we can be, because we're not requiring them to divest themselves of the interest or anything else. All they're going to do is just
disclose
it. Then we'll worry about to whom and under what circumstances and how after we define.
Well, it seems to me so far we've got two problems. On the question of whether we want to, on who to disclose to.
Right.
And secondly,
who must disclose?
Yeah.
What ownership require, or what participation?
What is
requires
a conflicting interest?
Yeah.
Now, frankly, the first part, of course, if he's a direct officer, my agent is clear. But that's going to be a very minority situation. I mean, that isn't going to. How often do you find a public servant is also, you know, a officer, high managerial agent? I think you'll find a few, and that'd be relatively few. Might be a director of a corporation. But that's going to be known anyway. I mean, it's.
What do we mean, since we're picking it apart?
Can I see it for a minute? Can I interrupt this for a minute?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's probably take a break. Carl and I, if I may speak for Harold, generally feel that this is a good approach. But two problems have been raised. One, a lesser problem that I think we can solve, and that is in paragraph one, to whom does one disclose the conflict? We say to the public, and if so, how's that done? And to his superior officer, is that enough?
How does the governor, who's the governor report to? God.
Apparently so.
How about the Attorney General?
The Attorney General. Yes. The Attorney General is mentioned because
you'll be, Lord.
Most commonly, it would be the Attorney General that you would ask for an opinion on whether there existed a conflict of interest.
The second problem is in the next to last line of two, a substantial interest. Well, directly or indirectly, what constitutes an indirect interest? And what constitutes a substantial interest? Now, I propose that it might be in violation of the Constitution for being a little vague on interest is okay, but a slight interest is okay, but a substantial interest is bad. And so, two questions then are that have been raised to deal with that.
I read. First place, does not, it only applies to executive officials, right?
No, any public servant. I'm sorry, on which end? Any public servant can be nailed for this.
Discretionary function in connection with a pecuniary transaction involving the government. That would not include the legislature.
We're not acting in his legislative capacity.
No. You wouldn't.
Well,
yeah,
a legislature
could, by on a vote, be functioning in connection with pecuniary transaction, can be involving the government.
Yeah, boy. I don't know. The thing I have, I'd raise a question about. Do we have anything similar to this now?
Well, these existing laws that are mentioned, if you look back on page
17.
List a number of statutes, most of which apply to public contracts.
Well, Jesus, that's a pretty damn wide standard for. The jury's got to decide whether it's a substantially discretionary function. Whether he's got a substantial interest. What I'm wondering is this really something that should be handled criminally? I've always felt the answer to this kind of problem is that...
Dismissal?
No. Well, no, as one is to make it mandatory to the people at least in positions of substantial trust to
disclose before the fact. I mean everything.
Yeah.
There's the public disclosure.
Well, that could probably be applicable to elected officials, but of course I think the majority of public servants that deal with contracts, for example, are longtime civil servants. Who are not answerable to the public. So. At least that's the way it seems to work in the Army.
Sure.
Is there any way you could have a...
And remember, Lee, all this does is just require him to disclose. He can still go ahead and act.
Oh, yeah. Didn't have to sell any of his equipment or whatever, he just had to dispose.
See, directly or indirectly a substantial interest. Boy, what is a substantial interest?
What's indirectly?
I look at a guy like Haynesworth, for example.
Funny that name should
you can't,
come up.
Well, you can't tell me that a guy that's worth that much dough, $14,000 in stock, I'm not saying, I think he should handle these affairs differently than he did, but I think it probably never even occurred to him. Whereas with somebody else, $14,000 in stock might be a pretty substantial factor.
Well, there's a problem.
And then what do you do with a guy who owns 100 shares of Georgia Pacific? Well, you say that's not substantial. Well, what is substantial?
Yeah, this is.
And I think an awful lot of people just wouldn't even think they had conflicts.
Well, one thing we can do, we can spell out in place of substantial interest saying using a quantity is, for example, 10% or more of the outstanding stock. Anyway.
Then it might not. It might be a joint venture.
10% of General Motors would be controlling, or Georgia Pacific. Practically any public corporation, that much is.
Well, let's explore your idea. You feel, Lee, that.
Well, let me make one other point, which I'd make about this statute, which I think is true of the Corrupt Practices Act, regardless of my own experiences, is that these acts are becoming more just a tool to politically embarrass people than they are to get at the real conduct they were designed to get at. I mean, all the last session, or the last election, all the demands were to inspect people's books and this kind of stuff. They're not serving their real purpose.
Well, I agree with that, but also at the same time, we're and I refer to the military investigation going on with a club. So I agree with your point that it's handy to embarrass others and serves perhaps no real purpose. But on the other hand, we are discovering that they're right in this area of civil servants owning outside dummy corporations through which things are purchased and they make a killing.
No, I'm not denying. I'm just trying to see what the counter influence is. And the question is there possibly a way we can take it out of the criminal field? And
well, one of the problems is it's extremely difficult to draft a conflict of interest criminal statute. In other words, not a disclosure statute, but just to make it a crime to have a conflict of interest. So in place of that, you try and get at it this way. Now, obviously, this isn't going to come up until probably after the transaction has been completed.
That's right.
The man has made the profit.
Yeah.
And it comes out some way. So you aren't going to be able to charge him with conflict of interest because we haven't been able to draft the effective statute in that area. So this is what you've got left.
And you have...
It's obvious that someone that knows they have a conflict of interest is either going to disqualify himself, or he's going to act without telling anyone about it. Or he's going to ask the Attorney General for an opinion whether whether this situation does create a conflict of interest or not.
Well, the thing is, is it necessary to make it a crime? I mean, the fact is, in the case of these guys in the Army and so forth, they've committed a crime anyway, basically.
Well,
embezzled funds.
Well, you'll notice on page 17, of all these statutes, none of them are in the criminal code. They're all part of the various regulatory codes. In other words, while we list some existing law here, there really is no criminal code statute in point.
I mean, if somebody unduly profits, I can see making a crime out of the person who unduly profits out of a government transaction. The question is...
Well, they could unduly profit here, and there isn't much you can do about it other than remove them from office.
Well, I disagree, though, Roger, that these other statutes are not criminal.
Well, they're criminal. It's just that they're not in the criminal code.
Yeah, but that's one of the major defects of our present statute, and that we hope not to perpetuate.
They're fairly consistent. The penalties are consistent. They're just about all misdemeanors, 1 year misdemeanors.
Well, I think we've reached the position that I think Harl and I perhaps like to see something, and please raise some substantial questions, but I would not favor it as long as we have those two vague areas of to whom he makes a report and what constitutes a conflict of interest. And I have no personal recommendations on how to resolve either one of them, and particularly the second one. The indirect substantial interest is almost beyond, I'm convinced it's void for vagueness right there. And the criminal penalty is saying that if you fail to disclose, if you have an indirect substantial interest,
by narrowing the statute, there'd be no problem because you could just require him to disclose to the Attorney General, period.
Yeah, that's what I say. I think we could, that one is relatively easy to resolve.
Number two is not so easy to resolve from a drafting point of view.
Well, what would you think if we sent it, if we eliminated it from our draft, but footnoted it on to the full committee explaining that there is substantial interest in this area, but raising the points that Lee has raised, and Harl's raised some, and I've raised some, that this statute doesn't do, I mean, this is a bad one as it sits right now. Do we all agree on that?
Yeah.
As it sits?
It just never would stand out.
Well, of course, we could solve part of that by, if we wanted to tighten it up, to say our own a substantial interest that we get out of the indirectly problem, we still have a substantial interest problem.
Yeah, and then you get the problem that you raised
for a jury to figure out if it's a substantial interest than if it was the proximate cause.
Yeah, in that area, you're almost going to have to name what you define what you mean by substantial interest, or just say, or owns any interest. Which is too broad.
Yeah, you'd have to have an interest to, and do away with directly, indirectly. Well, do away with directly, too. And then what happens to the situation where the husband or the child, which we...
That's the loophole.
That's the loophole. Just put it off into a trust, and, or bump it off to a kid, and you got it beat.
My wife.
Our partner.
Name for us. Let's get back to Hazel.
Glad you got here, Lydia.
Well, there's been some nice ones lately.
Well, why don't we do what you said and bring it up to the full committee and tell them of it.
Well, are we agreed? I want to make clear to them that we're not including it as it is. I don't want to come up to think that we're recommending it as it is. And if I would assure them that there is interest in this area, but we do not approve it in its present form, and we bring it up to them to resolve if they can, or send it back to us, or whatever.
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. When on preliminary draft number 2, I'll redraft it and try and solve as well as I can those problems. Then they can have a look at it. It'll be better than this. It still
okay.
might not
How about
be satisfactory.
Could you have every public servant disclosed to some agency?
The trouble is, the reason... What's public servant?
Well, we got that
defined. Yeah, we defined that in bribery.
But somewhere is where they've got some... The problem is you don't think it's fair to make people... Make a guy who's making $12,000 a year because he's got a pot full of dough otherwise. You just don't feel it's fair to make him disclose all these assets just simply to him. I mean, you're going to discourage some people working for state
government. Yeah, there'd be some resentment. In fact, one example is Bob, because under our definition of public servant, he is a public servant, at least when he's acting in these capacities.
Yeah, right.
And I don't know if I would be in favor of full disclosure of this.
Chandler was sitting in here earlier.
That's why I'm not so sure you made it a crime. I mean, it's the old problem in the legislature. If you have a disclosure provision, I think you're gonna have some guys who just say the hell with that
problem. Yeah. Well, okay, then Roger's gonna redraft this, put it in the second draft, but we are not approving section 6 as written. Okay, where do we go from here?
Well, we got 45 minutes, we can start.
What time are you leaving, about 4, Lee? Is that when you gotta be
there? I
don't
know, they're gonna call me.
Okay, well, tell Lee has to go. Let's...
Prostitution.
Male prostitution.
Male prostitution?
Male.
What is...
It's the first green
first
tab
first
in your...
part of the book.
After you run past the pink ones, hit the green.
Let's legalize it.
By gosh, we do have male.
Page 1, section 1. Definitions.
Well, that reminds me, in our sex area, we've defined out the male, in other words, in rape, specifically female, right? I don't have it in front of me, but I think we did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was raked over by one caller on the basis of, she said, you're always trying to protect the men, and I said, I didn't think that was necessarily true. I said, you know, it is possible to be the other way around. No, I didn't mention the Midnight Cowboy or anything, but, which is what we're getting into here. But she said, well, it's physically impossible for a male to be raped. And...
I tend to agree.
You think so? I'd hate to try and convince
it's
a Marion County jury.
It's physically impossible.
Jury,
well, I wouldn't say that it's through coercion that it couldn't be done, but I think it'd be physically impossible. Like
never
psychologically
had
possible.
Yeah, right. Well, I just noticed here that for instance, the crime of rape only deals with the male act upon the female.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we have prostitution, we're going to have both male and female prostitution.
Right, and this is relatively new in the law to make that clear.
The one thing about this is it makes it a consensual. You've got both parties.
It's just that they feel there's a burgeoning area in prostitution, and that is male prostitution.
You mean homosexual you're talking about your gigolo?
Both.
Yeah.
Both. Male prostitution. I think they sell themselves both to men and women, although they probably specialize. Those that sell themselves to men, probably only men.
Actually, maybe we ought to go see Midnight Cowboy if you haven't seen it.
I saw that.
I understand it's a good picture.
Very good. A bit depressing. But if you're a technical movie buff, it's a very good movie.
Dustin Hoffman. Brilliant.
Is that right?
Well, let's face it. This is one of those laws that we lick our eyes at anyway.
George Van Heusen does.
No, he yeah. chases him down. Did you read about that?
No.
He was going out of his office and cutting across the park blocks, and the gal came up and propositioned him. He turned around and ran back to the courthouse and got a deputy sheriff. Isn't that right, Ron?
No.
So he
no.
chased her, didn't he?
No.
He followed her.
When he was
followed
getting
her.
Into his car, he saw a woman he assumed to be a prostitute approach an elderly man in front of that rinky-dink club there on 3rd.
Yeah.
And it looked like a deal to him, so he followed them. They got into a cab, and he followed them to a rooming house on 12th and Jefferson. They went in, he waited a few minutes, and he went in and he checked all the doors. You see, he was listening around. And he finally found a door partially open. He looked in, and there they were on the bed. So he immediately ran out and called the sheriff's department, but they said they didn't have anybody that could get over there. So he ran out in the street and flagged down a city police car, and they went in and arrested the woman. And he was quoted saying that he was very unhappy about the fact that they couldn't find anything to charge the man with, who was an aged pensioner.
Loitering? Couldn't they
get what you can do on your slow Saturday afternoons.
No, apparently not even disorderly conduct, since it was in private. It was probably the old man's room.
Of course, there is one element of, I see certainly the male prostitute situation. Are we getting the gold coin here? We are.
Yeah. Sure.
There is a difference, there is a distinction from the standpoint of who is profiting from the crime. And there's also the old problem of when you make both parties the crime. Both the so-called victim. If you make the victim guilty of a crime, you just increase your enforcement problem.
That's one of the problems with the patronizing statute.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
Well, I have to be one that, yeah. that thinks we ought to give serious consideration, for example, the mere use of drugs and possession in small quantities shouldn't be a crime, simply because I think it would substantially enhance the enforcement effort by doing that issue. Same principle applies.
Who's the victim in a classic sense of prostitution?
I would say that the only victim would be theoretically society as a whole. I don't think that the prostitute herself is, and I don't think the patron is. And certainly the people that promote prostitution and profit from it aren't being harmed, they're profiting.
Then society would be the
victim. But the problem is, the money that is taken from prostitution is put into other illegal activities, which in the long run harm. Prostitute. For example, most of the professional lower-grade prostitutes in Portland are also heroin addicts. And a lot of this is brought about because those that promote prostitution, the pimps and the panderers, like to have the women working for them addicted.
Well,
makes it very
it's
manageable.
Classic. I mean, prostitution, of course, is an illicit enterprise which provides a means of income for people who will engage in those types of enterprises. Because although we make it illegal, society is going to buy it. It's a service that society wants. That's what it really amounts to. I'm not advocating.
Oh no, I agree.
This is
if you want to call it a problem, the problem of prostitution will be solved when women, all women, no longer say no. And then there will no longer be any demand for prostitutes. And that time may come.
I have my calendar here, Rod. Rod, could you be a little more specific? I got my calendar out here. Well, okay, let's...
Well, under section 1, subsection 1 just incorporates two definitions out of our sexual offenses draft. Sexual conduct, three of them, sexual intercourse and deviant sexual intercourse. Two, prostitute means a male or female person who engages in sexual conduct for a fee.
Well,
I think we haven't defined fee, because it doesn't necessarily have to be money.
But it's guest passing.
Although some of the other states have defined prostitute and use the term money rather than fee.
I would tend to say so.
One of the problems you can get into in defining prostitute is you confuse the prostitute with the traditional mistress, who in effect sells her sexual favors for consideration, but not
for an apartment or food or what.
And it isn't an intent to make that a crime.
I think
and
I
rationalize
think
that one, baby. We honestly ought to. Before we go after the gold coin, though, I think we ought to check with law enforcement authorities and see if they can give us some idea how many prosecutions are based upon evidence provided by the male. I think it's usually the vice officer.
I would say
I don't know.
I think it's the prosecutions for prostitution are based upon about 99% on testimony of vice squad officers. Because a complaint is very rarely brought on the basis of a complaint from a private citizen who would most obviously be a
he's not
patron.
Sure. Okay, that go on. I don't know why.
Breach of warranty, perhaps.
And of course, while I propose a patronizing statute, I argue against it because I think it would create more problems than it would solve.
What are the problems?
Well, there's one of them, is since most of your prosecutions for prostitution are based upon testimony of a vice squad officer, you've got a problem of accomplice testimony, of whether a patronizing statute is going to make it impossible for vice squad officers to...
The vice squad officer is in violation. He's committed a crime.
Are you saying now that the vice squad officers actually engage in prostitution?
Or no. Offers?
Offers, solicits, accepts. He accepts, yes. He accepts the solicitation.
He's got to go pretty far to get a good case.
Because, of course, prostitutes are rarely ever prosecuted for a sexual act. They're just
for the offer.
The solicitation. In fact, the Oregon case, the most recent Oregon case, is rather interesting because I give vice squad officers a lot of credit for cool, because the most recent one I read is that she was solicited in a bar and went down the street to a hotel room and they both undressed, and he was standing there while she was getting a bowl of water, and as she came over with a bowl of water he said,
you're
under arrest, I'm a vice squad officer, and I just can't imagine myself standing there stark naked in him.
It'd be hard to change your bar on my
room. Where was his badge?
He had a tattooed on his shoulder. One of the things that bothers me is...
Maybe he had a tape to his arm.
Tape
in his armpit.
Well, Roger, if a prostitute means you engage in the activity, then you can be charged with prostitution without being a prostitute, then, can't you?
Mm-hmm. Well, now, wait a minute.
Neither of you can be prostitutes. And you can still be charged with a crime of prostitution, because you have the crime of prostitution is one who offers or agrees to engage. And as we know now...
That's the act, it's punishable.
But agreed, yes. But what I'm saying is, you don't have to be a prostitute. You could both agree to do it, and the act and a crime has been committed, right?
Yeah, well, of course, the word prostitute isn't used in Section 2 prostitution. So that definition doesn't necessarily apply to Section 2.
That's what I mean. In other words, you can be guilty of prostitution without being a prostitute, which is... that same case that you talk about, the case was a tortured opinion, in my judgment, to read out the word common out of Portland's ordinance, if I recall correctly, common prostitute. Because all the officer had her on was the offer to do it one time.
One act.
Does that constitute common? And they, in my judgment, kind of had to read it kind of a tortured way to get common to mean
holds herself out to be a prostitute or something. It's a little awkward. And what I wonder if we're not building some of that.
Well, you see, there was a prior order, and there is no law in case that holds that. That to one solicitation is not sufficient to prove someone's a prostitute. You have to show a continuing course of conduct.
Let me ask you this, though. A person commits the crime of prostitution if he engages in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm purchasing the service.
That's the gold coin. It's written.
That engages in sexual conduct in return for a fee. Or if he offers to engage in sexual conduct in return for a fee.
Well, that would include.
Or if he agrees to engage in sexual conduct in return for a fee.
No, but in this section, too, you're not intended to get the gold coin.
No, for a fee is required to be read into it.
I know, but for a fee, but that's the problem. That's why I'm wondering why you aren't catching him under this statute. I engage in it for a fee.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that came up when
we
went over this, whether the man might be included in Section 2.
Just by the very nature that he engaged in an act for a fee, mm-hmm. that resulted in a fee.
But we construed in return for a fee, meaning the consideration is flowing to the.
You know, I think your definition ought to be
one direction rather than.
Yeah, I think it should be spelled out somewhere.
You can see some of the language of the other.
Oh, yeah, when you say who receives a fee.
That's Michigan language.
For engaging in sexual conduct, wouldn't that be it? Mm-hmm. Who accepts a fee. For engaging in sexual conduct. I'm looking at Section 2 and Section 1.
Well, of course, as I point out,